Residents of the northern part of the Texas Gulf Coast prepare for the worst as Hurricane Laura approaches, gathering speed. The latest coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Overnight, Hurricane Laura intensified 70%, approaching Category 4 as it neared the coastal border of Louisiana and Texas. Many cities have been evacuated. We'll be checking in with the Mayor Pro Tem of Galveston, who says residents there are bracing for a storm similar to Hurricane Ike. Also, a major beef between Harvard and Texas A&M as the two institutions engage in a public food fight over the safety of eating meat. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Standard gets underway right after this. It's Texas Standard Time on this Wednesday, August 26th. No one expected anything quite like this. It was a sentiment uttered in various ways as Hurricane Harvey pounded Texas 3 years ago this week. More on what's changed and what hasn't in a few minutes. But we begin today's broadcast with a storm bearing down on northeast Texas that many expected to intensify before landfall, but once again, not quite like this. I'm David Brown. Overnight, Hurricane Laura grew some 70% in strength with winds reaching Category 3 levels. And at last check, the hurricane was expected to grow to a Category 4 as it approaches the Texas-Louisiana coast. It's now expected to hit sometime overnight, early Thursday. More than 500,000 people in both states have been ordered to evacuate, the largest evacuation since the start of the pandemic. And over 6 million people are under flash flood watches on a line that stretches from south of Galveston into mid-Louisiana. Forecasters say there's an inland flood risk as far north as Arkansas or even southern Missouri. The biggest concern for many is wind damage, as forecasters say many trees are likely to be uprooted in Laura's path. In the words of one National Weather Service official, some areas, when they wake up Thursday morning, they're not going to believe what happened. Residents as far west as Houston may lose power. CenterPoint Energy predicts some closer to landfall may lose power for up to 2 weeks. In cities like Beaumont, Port Arthur, and Orange, buses were lined up all day Tuesday to help ferry evacuees out of town to hotels and, mindful of the pandemic, open-air emergency areas like the Circuit of the Americas in the Texas capital city. Checking the latest weather maps, the forecast track for Hurricane Laura shows Lake Charles, Louisiana to be the bullseye, but meteorologists have been careful about making precise predictions since the storm has been picking up such force and its trajectory could change in the hours before landfall. Galveston began evacuating yesterday, but Mayor Pro Tem Craig Brown plans to remain there with emergency officials as long as possible. He joins us now. Mayor Pro Tem Brown, thanks for taking time out to talk with us on what I know is an extremely busy time for you.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
The direction weather models are projecting Hurricane Laura's path this morning seems to put the Houston-Galveston area in a somewhat better situation than, say, Orange and Port Arthur and Beaumont when the storm eventually makes landfall. But there are still warnings for your area. What are your biggest concerns with this storm as we speak and how it could affect Galveston Island?
Well, our biggest, one of our biggest concerns is the intensity of the storm. It's moved from a Category 3, and there's a chance that it could go to a Category 4, which has devastating winds to it. The other concern is they still haven't pinpointed for sure, and we're right there on the edge. If this storm took a westward turn and came in here, that type of intensity, we would it'd be devastating on the destruction here on our island.
Is it the winds more than anything? Or I know that there's been a real concern about storm surges reaching as high as 10, possibly 14 feet at landfall.
It's both. The winds would, right now they said they possibly could have sustained winds of 130 miles an hour. But it's also the storm surge. We're an island right off a barrier island right off the coast of Texas here. And storm surge of 10, 12, 14 feet would cover this entire island and would be devastating not only to residential, but all of our commercial enterprises.
Let's talk about the residents. You've issued mandatory evacuations for residents. How have those been going?
It's been good. I'm still on the island here with certain first responder and city personnel, and it's very quiet on the island. We've had a good response from the residents here. We even assisted yesterday those that needed assistance. We brought in buses and, if needed, ambulances, and we moved those individuals off to the mainland.
How has COVID-19 complicated those efforts?
Complicated them quite a bit. With COVID-19, we had to have far more buses than normal so that we could socially distance individuals. And then providing housing on the mainland, we had to have enough housing where we could put one person per room. We've rented hotel rooms there, and that has caused a lot more on the logistics to make sure that we keep these people safe.
Where are you taking the evacuees? Where are evacuees going from what you are aware of?
We're working with the Texas Department of Emergency Management that is helping coordinate all of this. These evacuees are going to Austin, so they have hotel rooms reserved in Austin, Texas.
You've been a longtime Galveston resident. You've experienced hurricanes in the past. How does this compare with your experiences in the past?
We've had so many hurricanes here. You're right. Sometimes we take these hurricanes very lightly because we think, well, we can ride it out. This is different. This has a feel of Hurricane Ike to the residents here. Hurricane Ike was devastating to our community here and followed a path that was similar to this path that we're seeing with Hurricane Laura. The residents here and the city's taking this one very seriously. And we're hoping for the best.
Galveston Mayor Pro Tem Craig Brown, his city is hunkering down for what looks to be a very powerful Hurricane Laura, expected to make landfall near the Texas-Louisiana border overnight. Mayor Pro Tem Brown, thank you so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard, and please stay safe.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
As Texans along the northeastern Gulf Coast prepare for Hurricane Laura, it's all but impossible not to be reminded of Harvey. Current weather forecasts serve as a grim reminder that the Houston area is marking the third anniversary of that catastrophic storm. One of the major sources of flooding during Harvey, you may recall, came from the Attucks and Barker reservoirs inundated by rainfall. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider takes a look at whether the reservoirs have been made any safer since.
Like many of her neighbors in Houston's energy corridor, Katie Maynard was convinced her home would never flood. But 3 years ago, when she heard that the Army Corps of Engineers would be releasing water from the Attucks and Barker reservoirs, she knew trouble was coming.
Well, we are about, 4 miles from Barker and then Attucks. Like, we're just kind of at the intersection, I guess, of these two.
Maynard and her husband, Mark, spent the night in their daughter's upstairs bedroom. They woke up to find the house surrounded by floodwater. She and her husband tested the waters outside to see if they could escape on foot, and quickly realized if they tried, the current would sweep them away.
And that's when I just surrendered the notion that I wasn't going to get out without help, and so I put out the word on Facebook that we needed a boat.
Within minutes, a boat picked up Maynard and her daughter. Her husband stayed behind with their dog. The family was reunited the next day. The experience still haunts her.
That's a memory my daughter will have of being on my back, getting into a boat, and getting rescued. And it's not a memory I want for her future, right? I don't want her to have to carry her six-year-old out in a boat.
So how likely is it that another storm will force a release of water from the Attucks and Barker reservoirs? That's something the Army Corps of Engineers won't address. They're still in litigation with homeowners upstream of the reservoirs. But Byron Williams of the Corps' Galveston District told me the Corps has strengthened the structural integrity of the dams over the past 3 years.
We've done that by installing seepage control. And when I say seepage, that's just the movement of groundwater through the dam's embankments and foundation. And when the conditions are right, you know, that type of movement of water can move the soil particles and lead to dam failure.
All that reduces the risk of collapse, which is why the Corps had to drain the reservoirs during Harvey. What it hasn't done is make the dams higher or the reservoirs behind them deeper to accommodate more water, projects that would be hugely expensive. Philip Bedient chairs the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department at Rice University. He says the Corps' improvements have made the dam safer, but he says they haven't eliminated the possibility of a future release from the reservoirs. Bedient says that, according to the Corps' own operating manual,
if Harvey were to hit again next week, they would operate in pretty much the same way, because otherwise they again risk dam failure.
And what about the homes in the floodway? Bedient says there hasn't been much new development immediately downstream of the dams, but plenty of people have rebuilt just where they were before, many without elevating their homes to reduce the risk of flooding. That includes Katie Maynard, who moved back into her home 10 months after Harvey.
Because I love my house, I love this neighborhood. I want to trust that the $1 billion in bond money, you know, and all that is going right towards the things that need, you know, the projects that need to happen.
But she's still worried. She's convinced it's only a matter of time before a future storm forces another release from the reservoirs, flooding her neighborhood again. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Monitoring what Texans are talking about on this Wednesday, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello, Wells.
Hello, David. Hurricane Laura, obviously the talk of Texas. We're hearing from friends and listeners who may find themselves in the path of the storm. Nathaniel B. tweets us that he's in Longview, hunkering down right on the edge of the cone at this time. Obviously a little bit further in there from those people on the Gulf Coast we've been hearing from. We heard from the mayor pro tem in Galveston earlier. Here's what some folks on the ground there are saying via Twitter. XSuffer says, this is the first time I've had to evacuate for a hurricane in my life. I brought 3 pairs of underwear, 2 pairs of gym shorts, 3 jerseys, a toothbrush, and my computer gaming setup. I'm pretty sure I made the right choice. Meanwhile, Lorna Presswood has a slightly more ominous tweet. She says, we're already seeing high winds and rain in Galveston, and the storm is 290 miles out. People seem to think that Galveston will not have hurricane-force winds. We will, maybe not 130 miles per hour, but it will still be bad, she predicts. And Santiago Cato says that he's in San Antonio, having evacuated. He notes that, I hope I have something to come home to when this hurricane is over. Obviously, our thoughts are with all those people potentially impacted by the hurricane, David. I'll be back with more from Social later in the show.
We'd love to hear from you as well. Of course, only if it's safe and only if you've done what you need to do. You can reach out to us at Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar will be joining us once again in about 35 minutes with more comments from across the Lone Star State.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
Business on Your Money on the Standard, I'm David Brown. As Hurricane Laura swells in the Gulf, the potential economic impacts are becoming more clear. The energy industry is warning that the storm poses the biggest threat to U.S. oil output in 15 years, and it's shutting down refineries along the Texas-Louisiana coast. 84% of offshore output has been shut down, according to Reuters. That's close to the 90% shutdown the industry saw during 2005's Hurricane Katrina. Insurance Journal reports that Laura could leave in its wake between $5 and $12 billion in losses, depending on its track. We'll be keeping an eye on the latest here on The Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/on the job.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. There's a national race for a COVID-19 vaccine, and phase 3 trials on humans are now taking place across the country. But there have been concerns about who's included in these trials and the impact on communities. To learn more, Texas Public Radio's Maria Mendez takes us to 2 trial sites along the South Texas border.
That's a TV playing in the background of what at first glance looks like a typical lobby in a typical medical clinic. Workers and scrubs come and go with things like a vitals cart. Flyers tacked onto the walls remind people to wear a mask and maintain a distance. Another flyer on glossy white paper with blue and green lettering is for a new medical trial, a potential COVID-19 vaccine. I'm here in McAllen to talk with Shruti Konda, Chief Operations Officer for Centex Studies, a clinical research company. Right in this place, Centex is conducting vaccine trials for Moderna. That's a U.S. pharmaceutical company racing for a COVID-19 vaccine.
He is the one that prepares the drug.
He's called an unblinded pharmacist, so he's the only one that knows whether a patient's getting placebo or the vaccine.
So Moderna sends them vaccine doses, and they're testing them on volunteers from McAllen. Konda says they've been doing drug trials in McAllen since 2017, but this is their first vaccine trial.
We heard from the pharma companies that were looking for sites, and our business development team reached out to them, and we did a qualification visit.
And Moderna picked roughly 89 trial sites across the country. But the site in McAllen has a very special participant pool. The border city is 85% Latino.
When you look at Hispanics, traditionally we have high problems with hypertension, diabetes, heart problems, and we wanted to just make sure that, you know, Hispanics and other minorities were being taken in consideration as they did this trial.
Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar asked for Texas's hard-hit border communities to be included in the trials, but not all border residents have been as enthusiastic. I spoke with Alberto Castilleja. He's 23 and a finance student in Dallas, but he has family in Laredo, so when the pandemic hit, he moved back in.
You know, I've been keeping up with the news since, I would say, April. I've been aware of the, I would say, 17-plus vaccine trials that are happening right now.
When he found out there would be trials for a COVID vaccine in Laredo, he decided to look into it.
They were just looking for people who work at, you know, exposed environments or are at high risk. And there was, I would say, a checklist of 4 criteria to be met in order to participate, but the process didn't take more than 2 minutes long.
Castilleja wants to participate, but he's concerned that the trials may take advantage of a vulnerable community, a 95% Latino city with high uninsured and poverty rates.
So there's always that distrust, especially when there's cases like the 1976, you know, swine flu vaccination program that a lot of individuals got sick. So there's always certain things that the government or medical institutions have done that target people of color in ways that impact us negatively.
Medicine and clinical research have changed since those historical incidents. There's a rigorous, regulated process for research.
We're answerable to regulatory bodies and we take it very seriously.
That's Shruti Konda. She's the Chief Operations Officer for Centex Studies. She's at the clinical site in McAllen.
We have the Ethics Board, which is the Institutional Review Board. They're responsible for patient safety and making sure the patient's rights are not violated in any way. And then there's FDA that regulates all of this.
After Konda screens patients over the phone, if they qualify, the physician assistant, Wesley Keaton, screens them in person.
So when they get to phase 3 trials, those are basically the trials to see if the drug works and how long does it work for. So that means they already know it's safe. They've already used it on humans in smaller groups, and they know that there's hardly any side effects or very mild side effects. So.
And once a person is enrolled in the study, they're closely monitored for any potential side effects.
That's our observation room, and this is where the patients get vaccinated for the COVID trials, and we observe them for like 30 minutes.
They've enrolled more than 200 patients, and according to Centex, nobody has had any severe adverse reactions so far. But Alberto Castilleja says he's been worried about another issue with access, health insurance. As a DACA recipient, he says he didn't have insurance until landing an internship this summer with a brokerage firm that focuses on health insurance.
I got a sense of what the insurance industry looked like. I've never been insured, which is funny, but I finally got to understand how complex it is.
He's not alone. In Laredo, 29.1% of the population is uninsured, and in McAllen, it's 26.8%. according to census data from 2018. Health insurance is key because without it, the vaccine could be quite expensive. And at a congressional hearing in July, Moderna said it planned to profit off the vaccine, which has already received federal funding.
We provided to them almost $2 billion.
That's Congressman Henry Cuellar. So Moderna got taxpayer funding and will charge taxpayers a second time when the vaccine becomes available. That could mean that taxpayers here in border communities that are helping test this new vaccine could potentially not have access because of the high price, estimated at $60 for the two doses needed.
There is a law that says that all Americans will have access. So if somebody doesn't have insurance, there would not be a hurdle to get a vaccine.
Congress has continued to work with Moderna, so if its vaccine is successful, the federal government may have to pick up the tab for those who can't afford it. But Moderna isn't the only company working on a vaccine. Centix and McAllen is starting vaccine trials with another company, AstraZeneca, soon. AstraZeneca did promise to price their vaccine at no profit. Moderna did not respond to our request for comment, but its CEO has said it will work out lower pricing for large orders and will be, quote, responsible on price. Still, its vaccine is reported as the most expensive one from all the contenders. Back in Laredo, Castilleja finally got a response after weeks of waiting. He went in for a screening.
All the questions I had in mind and concerns were addressed by the medical staff.
Staff also warned him he could develop side effects like fatigue, a rash, or even a fever. And after weighing all the information, Castilleja decided to enroll in the study.
This has the potential to make things go back to a new normal, reduce deaths if it's effective. And lastly, it was very comforting knowing that there was other people from Laredo signing up to this trial the day I got there to the clinic.
He'll have to go back for a booster shot in September. Meanwhile, officials in the border county of Starr have announced they are working on launching a vaccine trial there to recruit more Latino participants. I'm Maria Mendez in Laredo.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Officials in southeast Texas continue preparing for Hurricane Laura. Mark Flathouse is the Emergency Management Coordinator for Fort Bend County. He spoke during a news briefing this morning.
The next 12 hours are critical for Fort Bend County to see if, one, that we are going to be impacted and what impacts are going to be due. And the other thing is if it does not impact us directly, that we are here for all the other citizens on the coast and throughout Texas.
In neighboring Harris County, Judge Lena Hidalgo today signed a disaster declaration due to the imminent threat of damage from the storm. Authorities believe the body of a missing Fort Hood soldier has been discovered about 30 miles from the Central Texas military base. 23-year-old Sergeant Elder Fernandez was last seen on August 17th. Temple police say a body was found late Tuesday night hanging in a tree. Identification recovered at the scene indicates the victim may be Fernandez, but there is no forensic confirmation yet. Fernandez is the third Fort Hood soldier to go missing in the past year. His disappearance came less than 2 months after the remains of Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen were discovered. Her death prompted the U.S. Army to launch an independent review of Fort Hood's culture. University of Texas at Austin students start fall semester classes today. UT Austin is offering a mix of online, in-person, and hybrid courses. KUT's Dani Matias reports on the university's reopening plans amid the coronavirus pandemic.
UT Austin says it'll administer more than 5,000 COVID-19 tests weekly, including testing students, faculty, and staff who are asymptomatic. University officials encourage everyone to screen themselves daily for symptoms by using UT's Protect Texas Together app. Face coverings are required when inside any UT building, unless someone is eating, drinking, or alone in a private office or dorm room. Personal hygiene products and sanitizing stations are available throughout campus.
Donia Matias reporting. And new home sales in Texas are leading a summer surge in residential housing activity, according to Texas A&M's Real Estate Center. Economist Jim Gaines explains the number of new residents sold last month jumped 28% compared to July 2019. That's while existing home sales increased 13.5%.
It's actually a surge in new home building and high demand for even more units. So quite honestly, the home builders just simply can't build enough.
Gaines says the spike in housing sales overall is due to a drop-off in activity during the early months of the pandemic in April and May. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Department of Agriculture. Because of educators and school nutrition professionals, students are taught about local products and nutrition to make smarter choices about eating. More at farmfreshfriday.org.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Few things are as inexorably tied to the idea of Texas in the popular imagination as cattle ranching. So as it were, beef is a sort of centerpiece around which all kinds of Texan dishes resolve, whether you're craving smoked brisket, chicken fried steak, or just a good old-fashioned hamburger. But another beef is taking shape between Texas A&M and Harvard University, with each institution accusing the other of conflict of interest when it comes to dietary research around the role of red meat in the American diet and whether beef consumption is indeed linked to heart disease and cancer. In fact, the food fight is getting ugly, reports Jason Hyde. He's senior editor at Texas Monthly. Jason, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks.
How did all this begin? I heard that there was some kind of report published last fall that involved some researchers linked to Texas A&M?
Yes. Last fall in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which is a prominent journal in the field, there was a series of studies that sort of sought to upend the consensus around the idea that there's a proven link between the excess consumption of red meat and heart disease and cancer. And these studies came out and very quickly got translated into headlines in mainstream newspapers saying maybe red meat is not as bad for you as people mm-hmm. thought. And Texas A&M became part of that because the lead author of the study, a man named Bradley Johnston, was at the time being recruited by Texas A&M to come work there and had received funding from Texas A&M's AgriLife, which is the school's agriculture college and four state research agencies under its umbrella. Right. And one of the main critics of these studies is a man named Walter Willett of Harvard. And he began talking about how AgriLife was part of a disinformation triangle because it accepted money from the beef industry.
I see. Okay. Now let's back up for just a moment, because it's not unusual for researchers to disagree with each other over, you know, studies and to ask for further studies and that kind of thing. But mm-hmm. it seems like there are personalities involved, and from what I hear you saying, mm-hmm. allegations of a conflict of interest on the part of Texas A&M. Is that right?
Correct. Texas A&M accepts money for research from the beef industry. Now, they'll tell you it's a very small percentage of the overall amount of money they take. Patrick Stover, the vice chancellor in charge of AgriLife, even pointed out to me that they actually, if you look at the bottom line, take way more money from plant-based industries. But Walter Willett and Harvard will tell you that anything that comes out of AgriLife is possibly suspicious because of that money they accept from the beef industry.
But wait, folks, there's more, because Texas A&M pushed back against Harvard, accusing them of bias, right?
Exactly. They will point out to you that Walter Willett and the other critics at Harvard don't always disclose that they take money themselves from some plant-based industries and interests, such as the California Walnut Commission and the Kind Healthy Snack Company. It's hard for the researchers in these nutrition scientists not to accept some funding from these industries, because there is a limit to how much government and academic sources have available to them. And some of these industries have real problems that they want nutrition scientists and other scientists to look into mm-hmm. and are willing mm-hmm. to share the money to do that.
But I want to get back to the spat between these two institutions, elite institutions in their own mm-hmm. spheres, which brings us, in a way, to the nub of the question, and that is how much of this food fight is, in fact, a kind of culture clash. You have an elite East Coast university calling mm-hmm. an agricultural school in the South, albeit one of the most prominent, that it's biased on behalf of meat, and Texas mm-hmm. A&M firing back and saying, "Nah, you guys are all about veggies," and it comes to the dollars. Is that what's really at play here? Is there a culture clash going on or no?
I think there is a culture clash in that sense, that A&M, as they will tell you, is a what's known as a land-grant university, and it's part of their charter to not only seek out answers to academic questions, but to work on behalf of industry to solve problems. So A&M accepts money from a variety of industries in the agricultural field. Harvard is not a land-grant university, and the critics that are arguing there are nutrition scientists, and their interest is really just looking at the health effects of diet on individuals. And so they are just coming at the question from a very different angle. So there is a culture clash there, but there's also a question about nutrition science and how it best can be done. The A&M researchers are really pushing for more evidence-based, what they call evidence-based science. But Harvard will tell you that that's just a cover for pushing these industry interests.
Jason Hyde is a senior editor at Texas Monthly. We'll have a link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Jason, thanks.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, sharing that regular screenings like mammograms and colonoscopies are essential preventative appointments. Early detection of cancer often leads to better outcomes. More at texasoncology.com.
Is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Protests in Wisconsin continue over the police shooting of a black man, Jacob Blake, on Sunday. This while protests continue across the country after the in-custody death of Houston native George Floyd in Minneapolis back in May. Activists in Texas are finding that these months of protesting against police violence is not only tough, it's also stressful work. KERA's Saida Hassan reports on how some are finding help to keep up the fight for change while avoiding burnout.
After months of being cooped up at home during the coronavirus pandemic, Fort Worth resident Octavia Woodard is spending her summer demonstrating in the streets.
There were times I was on the front line and I was leading some of those chants. I was out there and it was just an adrenaline rush. So it was a release for me.
Woodard is with Enough is Enough Fort Worth, the group of community organizers formed after the police killing of George Floyd on May 25th. Over the past few months, members have spoken against systemic racism at public meetings. They've organized back-to-school donation drives, and they've continued to protest across North Texas. Woodard, who is Afro-Latina, says it's cathartic to call out the racism that permeates life for so many Black Americans. At the same time, she's aware of the potential danger.
You know, I did experience situations where there was like people spitting on us, people who threw a noose in the middle of the street while we were walking, you know, cars trying to run through the crowd while I'm out there in the middle of the street.
She began to feel anxious and worried for her safety. Woodard began reaching out to mental health professionals in North Texas. On August 1st, Enough is Enough Fort Worth put on an event for local protesters focused on mental wellness and healing. There was a yoga class, information on finding affordable therapy, and a mental health check-in.
So we allowed people the opportunity to just speak and talk about some of the emotions that they're going through, or is there something that they're struggling with and they need to figure out how to get through that.
Woodard has learned to take breaks for her mental health, but there's no slowing down her activism.
This feels like a tipping point to me.
Lauren Duncan is a professor at Smith College, where she teaches courses on the psychology of politics and activism. Duncan says there are many factors that have created momentum for anti-racist activism.
Partially, I would say it's because of the pandemic, and people have a lot of time to be on the internet, to be reading. It feels like there's a level of awareness in the culture, especially in white culture, in the majority white culture. It feels like it's new.
Nationwide protests have inspired measurable changes, from police budget cuts to the removal of Confederate monuments. Duncan says the power of protesting provides a sense of hope and agency.
Research has shown that for members of groups who are discriminated against, that participating in collective action aimed at redressing the discrimination or making things better is actually a positive thing for their mental health.
Ongoing protests are also helping people build communities of support.
If you don't have that, you're probably not going to persist for too long because it's just too hard. It's too draining.
Avoiding burnout is a tricky balancing act. Lakita Cook is a licensed professional counselor in Dallas. She's worked with clients who have complex histories of trauma. Cook says protesters are often faced with jarring imagery and violence, and taking breaks is essential. Think of the movement as a marathon, not a sprint, she says, or maybe a basketball game.
Not everybody is on the floor the entire game. Take people out, you put people in, some people rest while some people are still playing, because we're all fighting for the same goal. We're all trying to move in the same direction, but we don't have to be on. We don't have to be active 100% of the time.
Cook encourages demonstrators to pay attention to potential signs of burnout and create plans for self-care. She says if you have an existing mental health condition, know your risk levels before attending a protest and look for ways to decompress afterward. I'm Saida Hassan in Dallas.
The Llano Estacado is an enormous mesa. It covers more than 37,000 square miles of Texas and New Mexico. On this side of the state border, it's said to start north of Amarillo, ending south of Odessa. But how did it get its name, and what exactly does it mean? Well, Texas Standard commentator W.F. Strong says there's a theory about that. Actually, more like five of them.
Today, the Llano Estacado has been immortalized in art. Just think of this song by Gary P. Nunn.
It's a Llano Estacado. It's the Brazos and the Colorado. It's the spirit of the people who share this land.
One thing all the theories about its origin story agree on is that there's a reason the name is Spanish. It's credited, at least in part, to conquistador Francisco Coronado, who called the area Los Llanos, the plains. And that's where the stories begin to diverge. The most common one is the Llano Estacado means staked plains because estacado is the past tense of estacar, a verb meaning to stake or to stake out. The belief was that the vast spaces in the mesa were so disorienting that early explorers and settlers needed to leave stakes in the ground to navigate in a straight line and to leave a direct line of retreat should they need it. But others say that in the time of Coronado, the term estacar had a different meaning. It meant palisaded plains or stockaded plains looking like a fort. If you approach the caprock as Coronado did, and as I have done myself west of Amarillo along the Canadian Breaks, from a distance of 20 miles, the rise onto the caprock does indeed look like a fortress stretching as far as one can see. But here's another bit of the puzzle. The great geographer and historian John Miller Morris tells us that Coronado never wrote the words Llano Estacado. But Coronado did leave us a detailed description of Llano in a letter to the King of Spain. He said, "There is not a stone, nor a bit of rising ground, nor a tree, nor a shrub, nor anything to go by." This brings us to Morris's most compelling theory about the name. With no trees and shrubs available, explorers and hunters needed to stake out or hobble their horses at night, or they'd be gone in the morning. All of the theories have their appeals, but I doubt the origin of the name will ever be settled. Just like its name, the infinite flat land, the ocean of grass that once supported millions of buffalo, remains a romanticized landscape of mystery to this day. There's a sublime book by Shelley Armitage called Walking the Llano. Ms. Armitage has lived on the Llano off and on most of her life. She writes, "There's been no poet of these plains, but there is a poetry of the plains. This part of the Llano exists as a shape of time, requiring the rhythm of a habit of landscape, of the repetition of experiencing. She quotes Mary Austin, "It's the land that wants to be said." Armitage also tells of the advice of an elder of the White Mountain Apaches who said, "Wisdom sits in places. It's like water that never dries up. You must remember everything about places. You must learn their names. You must remember what happened at them long ago." We must do this for the Llano Estacado in poetry and prose and song. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F. Strong is a Fulbright scholar and professor of culture and communication at the University of Texas, RGV. You can check out more of his stories from Texas at texasstandard.org, at Apple, or wherever fine podcasts are served.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Texas Land Commissioner George P. Bush recently shared a video on Twitter of vehicles with busted out windows in a parking garage. He added that the footage was taken, quote, the same night the city of Austin voted to cut $150 million from the police department. Well, is that a fact? Madeline Meckelberg looked into it for PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American-Statesman. Madeline, welcome back. Good to talk with you.
Great to speak with you.
So give us the background information here. What exactly did George P. Bush's tweet say?
So he shared this to Twitter right after the Austin City Council voted on its budget for the upcoming fiscal year. And that budget got a lot of attention, and we can talk about that a bit here. But he shared a video in his tweet that showed more than a dozen vans that are sitting in a parking garage, and all of them have busted rear windshields. There's no audio in the video. You can hear somebody walking by. But the text of his tweet reads as follows. He said, "This was taken tonight in one of the parking garages used by the Texas General Land Office and other state agencies in downtown Austin. The same night the city of Austin voted to cut $150 million from the Austin Police Department. The need for police funding is as clear as ever. This is a dangerous path to go down."
All right, so let's do some background here. The $150 million cut in that was voted on by the Council of the City of Austin made national headlines. A lot of conservatives railing against it as an example of sort of political correctness, run amok, that kind of thing. What exactly did Austin City Council vote to do, and was it indeed a $150 million cut?
So the important thing here when we're talking about the context of Commissioner Bush's tweet is that this happened on August 13th. That's when they had this vote on their budget.
All right.
And they approved their $4.2 billion budget, which did include about $150 million in planned cuts to the Austin Police Department, although only $20 million of those cuts were immediately planned. And the cuts were largely redistributing funds from the police department to other city departments for different law enforcement roles and different emergency response roles. But the important thing here is, while he gets those details largely correct in his tweet, the problem is that he connects this decision to the incident he's recording in the video, and his timing is off.
His timing is off. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So the vehicles that he shows in his picture, they're owned by different state agencies, and they all keep them parked in a parking garage near the Texas Capitol. Okay. And the Capitol and the surrounding complex, including these parking garages, they're actually not under the Austin Police Department's jurisdiction, even though they're in the city. They're under the jurisdiction of the Texas Department of Public Safety, or DPS. And DPS told me that during a regular morning patrol of one of these parking garages, an officer found these vehicles with shattered windows. They think it was from a BB gun or an air pellet gun. And they haven't made any arrests yet. They're still investigating. But we're coming back to the timing question. The most important thing here is that these vehicles, the damage was not discovered the same day as the city council vote. They were actually discovered with these broken windows on August 8th. 5 days before the council voted on the budget on August 13th.
Okay. I suppose a defender of George P. Bush might say, well, he's talking about the larger issue of lawlessness in the Texas capital city, right? I mean, he didn't necessarily say explicitly that, or did he say explicitly that that these pictures were taken on the same night as the vote?
He did say explicitly this was taken tonight, the same night that the city of Austin voted on these cuts to the police department. Mm-hmm. He was tying the damage there to the cuts to the Austin Police Department, even though this is really a separate jurisdiction, a separate issue that occurred days earlier.
Interesting. Well, do you have enough information there to make a ruling?
We do. We rated this claim false.
False. George P. Bush's claim that a rash of vehicle break-ins in a state agency parking garage happened the night Austin voted to cut police spending. This claim was checked by Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas. Madeline, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening
to the Texas Standard.
Joining us again, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. I'm sure Texans are all talking about the same thing on this Wednesday, Wells.
Decidedly so. We're continuing to monitor social media in advance of Hurricane Laura's landfall. So more on that in a moment. But for now, a huge loss in the Dallas underground music scene that's already reverberating across the globe. Riley Gale, frontman for Dallas-based thrash metal band Power Trip, is dead at 34. Some folks out there may not have heard of them, but relentless touring and a pair of acclaimed albums brought Power Trip a degree of influence and acclaim that's rare in the underground. Their last full-length LP, 2017's Nightmare Logic, topped numerous end-of-year lists and even earned a Best New Music rating from indie rock critical arbiter Pitchfork. And Riley Gale most recently collaborated with Ice-T on the rapper and actor's recently reignited metal band Body Count. And I should note here that Gale's contribution to that song, Point the Finger, was inspired in part by the Dallas police killing of Botham Jean in his own apartment, speaking to the progressive politics that Power Trip imbued in their songs. In a 2018 interview, Gale said, quote, "We might be all white males, but this is not a band for white males to enjoy and be dumb rednecks." Obviously, progressive politics imbued through all of their songs. The family and band asking for privacy at this time and directing any calls for flowers or anything like that to be donated to Dallas Hope Charities. And I should add that here, 201 reactions on social media speak to what a friendly character Gale was, in contrast with his ferocious presence on record and on stage. Mm-hmm. One of our longtime listeners, Priscilla, tweeted me that he was one of the best guys I've known, legitimately was so proud to see how much he'd grown in the 15 years I'd been lucky enough to have known him. So a huge hole there in the Texas music scene that's I think their most recent tour was of Asia. So they do span the globe and have lots of fans, and very sad news musically. Indeed. As you noted, David, Hurricane Laura, man, 2020 just does not let up. We're continuing to monitor the latest on that and just seeing continued reports of what it's like on the ground there with folks preparing for evacuation as we near landfall this evening, I believe. Is the latest, correct?
Yeah, that's what they're saying right now is that landfall, it appears that Lake Charles is right there, Louisiana, is right there in the bullseye of, but this has been changing so much. Yeah. Everyone was expecting the storm to intensify overnight, but I think very few people were expecting that it would be approaching a Category 4 by landfall. It was very interesting to see a headline in USA Today that moved as the broadcast was on the air. It said, this storm is unsurvivable. So please don't take Goodness these gracious. Warnings lightly if you are in this in the line of these storms as they move northward along the North Gulf Coast of Texas. Do heed the warnings and the advice of emergency officials. This is a story we continue to track here at the Texas Standard with our team of reporters and partners statewide. Keep it here for the latest. And as always, you can keep up with the news 24/7 at texasstandard.org. I'm David, along with Wells and the rest of the crew, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Muldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family,
and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.